You're listening to the podcast for Inforum, an innovation lab at the Commonwealth Club. Buy tickets to upcoming live events in San Francisco at inforumsf.org. Want even more Inforum? Find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram as InforumSF. Good evening. And welcome to Inforum at the Commonwealth Club. I'm Marissa Levine, Director of Inforum, and tonight it is my pleasure to be here on Valentine's Day, moderating our annual Valentine's Day conversation. And rather than be at an overpriced restaurant, we're here with some really fantastic experts. Jess Carboneau is currently the in-house sociologist at the dating app Bumble. She was named one of Fast Company's most creative people back in 2017, and she's been called the Dr. Ruth of the swipe right generation and the Nate Silver of online dating. Maisha Battle is a Bay Area sex and dating coach with a career that started in high school when she counseled peers around sex and dating, led to a master's in psychology, a sex coach certification, and a busy practice today providing support. Her Instagram bio reads the Oprah of sex. Not to be outdone with the snappy titles, Dan Jones, editor of the long-running weekly Modern Love column at the New York Times, was termed the male Carrie Bradshaw of Sex and the City fame early in his career. We'll see what he thinks about that.
Don't encourage that.
Okay. The Modern Love world has spun into videos, very popular podcast, college essay contests, and even an upcoming Amazon series later this year. He's also the author of two books. So tonight, I'm on stage with Dr. Ruth, Nate Silver, Oprah, Carrie Bradshaw, and these three fabulous panelists. And there is a ton to talk about. So we called this night's event Modern Love, partially an homage to Dan's column, but also we're in modern times. Things keep changing. And backstage, we were actually talking about the concept of kind of love as a fairy tale versus the reality of modern love. And Dan, I'm going to start with you. Tell us, why did you even call your column Modern Love? Where did that come from? What were you trying to talk about?
It came from the David Bowie song, Modern Love.
Okay.
And you know, I wish we had all these names that we came up with for the column, and I wish I'd preserved it. I only remember one of the other names, which was Truly, Madly, Deeply.
You're into the music thing.
And I'm glad we didn't go with that, because I'd be called the Truly, Madly, Deeply editor for all these years. But we called it Modern Love, and we also considered Postmodern Love, which was a little too nerdy, I think. We called it Modern Love because the style section is about trends and things happening now and with a contemporary edge. So the word modern fit that. And love, we wanted to broadly interpret so that the column would have some sort of longevity. So we didn't want to limit it to romantic love and that it would be all forms of love. And that was a good decision.
I was going to say, that's been working out well.
Yeah.
How many columns have you published to date with Modern Love?
I don't know. I'm not very good at math, but it would be 52 times almost 15. I think it's like 700. Yeah.
That's wild. And how many have you read to get to 700 that you've published? I think that's a deeper question that we're all...
Yeah, it depends.
How many of you have actually ever submitted a Modern Love column? Okay, there's a few of you. There's a few of you.
It depends how you define read, I guess.
Now you know. Skim.
I've opened at least 100,000 emails of people wanting their essay published. And then I read enough to make a decision.
Now, Jess, you work for Bumble, which didn't even exist when Dan started the Modern Love column back in 2004. Can you tell us a little bit about how you got to Bumble? Like, what's your take on this modern love space, and how did you get there?
Well, my entree into this whole world of modern love and the theoretical constructions of love began when I was doing my PhD in sociology at UCLA. And like any other single young person in the greater LA area in 2014, I was on Tinder, swiping left and right, not only for the purpose of enhancing my abilities to write my dissertation, or avoid doing my dissertation, rather. I was on Tinder, and I matched with the founder of Tinder, Sean Rad. And rather, yes, rather than going on a date, I went to the office, and 30 minutes later, I told him that they needed me. And he said, yes, we do need you. And after learning that they had only collected at that point, they'd been around for about a year at that point, and they only had numbers related to the number of men and women on Tinder, they definitely needed me. So I was there for 4 years and acted as their sociologist. And now I'm at Bumble running research for them. And it's been an amazing journey to see the evolution of the online dating space since I started doing my research in 2009 as a graduate student and now being one of the players in developing the product.
And then I think the kind of natural entree is when Bumble is done with people or driving people crazy, that's where my issue comes in.
Or they're currently being driven crazy by dating apps and they come to me too, yeah.
So how did you kind of find your way into this crazy world of love and sex and dating?
Yeah, it's a long story. And I've actually played with a lot of different titles for myself. Mm-hmm. Oprah of Sex is a new one that I'm trying on. But certified sex and dating coach, feminist sex and dating coach, those are both things that I identify as well. And I think largely how I see dating and relationships being modernized is that we can now integrate this idea of feminism into our everyday dating experiences and kind of use that as an umbrella to guide us towards partnerships that feel more egalitarian. And I think we're in a place right now culturally where those conversations are deepening and expanding and happening on, you know, a one-on-one basis too within partnerships. So I actually saw an uptick in people coming to me after the election of Trump because in their relationships, they were really struggling with some of the things that were coming up for them and their families and relationships and turning to the person, you know, next to them in bed going like, can I trust you? these conversations, I think, are continuing to happen. And I think it's really important to have that as top of mind when I'm working with people, because it's something that's going to continue to plague dating as we move forward.
Now, before we go any further, I actually wanted to do a quick audience poll. Can you raise your hand if you are currently single? Hey. Nice. Woo. Raise your hand if you're currently dating. In a committed relationship? In a not committed relationship? This is San Francisco. Married.
I was expecting more.
Yeah, I know. Married? Okay. Have you ever been on a dating app? Okay, lots of hands. Wow. Awesome. So we've got a really mixed crowd, which is super interesting. And who's never been on a dating app?
That's awesome.
Okay.
Really?
Who thinks they should try a dating app but are super terrified of a dating app? Nobody. Okay, so if you're not doing it, just one? We've got one. Okay, good. So that's a good frame of reference for you guys. We've got a pretty broad strokes crowd here, which I think is really interesting. So the other thing, and I think all of you touch on this a little bit, is that when we talk about modern love, we're actually not just talking about dating or romance necessarily. We're talking about all kinds of relationships. We're talking about how we navigate relationships. We might be talking about the crappy parts of relationships. I've cried at more modern love columns than I can think of. And I bet you have too. How have you guys kind of navigated this concept of like the fairy tale of love versus the reality of love? And where does that enter? Jess, I know you talk a lot about what people think they want.
Sure.
Versus maybe what they could want or what they might want if they open themselves up to it.
Of course. Well, I think that when sociologists are thinking about love, we've often put it into two camps, this prosaic camp, which is what we observe in our daily life and experience, either ourselves or the people around us with whom we have the strongest connections. We learn about it through our parents, through transmission information, through observation. But then there's obviously the romantic version of love, which we consume via the media, and that's most laden with myths. But then I also think that there's a more marked version of love, which I think hasn't been talked about as much, but I think really one of the fundamental tenets of it is that we try to maximize for what we can get on the basis of what we're actually getting within our own experiences, dating online, dating offline. And
what do you mean by maximizing? What do you mean by that?
So I think that it's sort of a behavioral economics term. We go out there and we try to get everything that we want that we're able to actually get, with an understanding that we probably won't get everything, but we're going to strive for the ideal as much as we possibly can. Mm-hmm. Because the market just functions efficiently. And if you've dated online, you can see that it's a very efficient market. It may not lead to the outcomes you want, but it's efficient. And I think that, you know, people often ask me, and it goes to this question you ask about whether people know what they want. I often wonder whether or not people are better matchmakers for themselves than the algorithms. But what I do believe is that the algorithms bring us so far, and then it's ultimately up to the people to make decisions. And whether or not they're aware of what they want, what they need, et cetera, is an issue that's discussed with a psychologist rather than a sociologist.
Well, actually, so then let's transition a little bit.
Yeah.
How does that play out, Maisha? Like, how does that kind of what you think you want or what you're striving for then play out in some of what you're seeing?
Right.
Both the good and the bad, because yeah. I'm assuming people come to you with both.
Typically, they come to me with the bad, because by the time someone's ready to seek help, they're typically in a crisis. Mm-hmm. That goes across the board for most, you know, helping professions. But as we were discussing backstage in the green room, a lot of my clients come to me at a point of crisis of not knowing what they want. So using an app as a tool is hard for them. Also dating in, you know, IRL is hard for them because there's not really that security with knowing what your core values are or what you'd like to invite into your life. So that in and of itself is a crisis. The other crisis I see is with couples who have partnered that they've really deprioritized sex in their partnership. So that's my job as a sex and dating coach. I work with people around issues that are happening in their intimate lives. And I have couples that come to me and say, like, we are so good in so many areas of our life. Sex is just one of those things that has never clicked with us or is currently not clicking with us. And I think some of them, and I was expressing how it's probably a bigger number for me than a typical person. but a lot of them come to me and say, you know, that's never really even factored in. When they were looking for partners, sex wasn't the thing they were looking for. They were looking for long-term stability. They were looking for partnership. They were looking for someone to have a family with, which you would think means that they were going to have sex at some point. But I've had couples who've come up with very creative ways to have sex without being super into it. And, you know, that's just the fact of the matter. And so it's interesting for me because as someone who has always valued and prioritized sex in my relationships, I see that as an odd choice, but I also understand that everyone's different in how they select their partners. I also understand that there's a stigma against making sex a priority in your life. And hopefully what I do is give people permission to say, like, yeah, this is important. I want a partner with whom I connect sexually with, and this isn't happening, and it's affecting our whole relationship, so we need to really get back to the drawing board.
So Dan, to kind of bring you into this a little bit, I've read essays on everything under the modern love umbrella, the good, the bad, the ugly, the stigmatized, the I thought I knew what I wanted and I didn't. Where have you seen these things crop up? Have you seen it change over time? Like the things that you were getting as submissions in 2004 versus the submissions now? Is that something that you can talk about, like the relationship to technology or changing, you know, social norms? I mean, I think it's interesting, you know, even Bumble now is very female forward. That's this huge change in how we're thinking about dating and relationships. And that could be really interesting from the gender norms perspective. But what have you seen kind of in these shifts in how people are thinking about things?
Well, first, like Maisha, people who write to me write out of disappointment and out of conflict, because conflict is the driver of narrative.
No happy stories?
If you begin your essay, I'm happy and I got what I want, there's not too far that you can go from there. So it's disappointment. It's pervasive. And I mean, I'm interested in the sort of historical context of love being the thing that brings us together, and that it wasn't always until really recently in the history of humanity. And I find myself thinking of love as like a person or something, or a creature, and feeling a little sorry for all the pressure that's put on love as being the thing that is going to bring us together, unite us for life, and make us feel good. And that is what we look for now, and that is a steep climb, and it has to encompass sex and companionship and parenthood and soulmateness, whatever that gooey category includes. It has to get you through fights. And it's too much, you know? It's too much pressure on love. And I think if there's a fantasy that's dangerous, it's the fantasy that that this person is going to make us feel good all the time and that we're going to feel in love. And the idea that that if I don't feel in love with you anymore, then we need to move on. I think there are probably a lot of relationships that end that were salvageable and that could be enjoyed again and could be good, that, you know, that didn't rise to this bar that we've set for ourselves for what love is. And that's, I mean, my education.
Who do you blame for that? Out of curiosity, who would you guys blame the fairy tale on? Where are we getting this pressure creature? Who is projecting
blamed,
the pressure?
I mean, I would
not to you know pinpoint.
Yeah, blame is it's a consequence of equality in a lot of ways. Like it's a consequence of dependency falling away and being this. You know, we're all free agents, you know. Yeah, I don't need you and you don't need me. So if we're going to stay together, it's going to be for love. And if love isn't going to be enough, then we're not going to stay together. So, you know, it's a consequence of progress.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Maisha, from the feminist, you talk a lot about kind of bringing the feminist into your work. And a lot of that, you know, has been a narrative that can come about because there isn't that same dependency. You know, there's, relationships aren't necessarily for money anymore or for stability. How is that? Where do you see gender roles coming up? And Jess, I want to hear kind of from the Bumble perspective too, but like, where do you see gender roles playing an issue in any of this or just dynamics in general when it comes to those dependencies or needs that people may or may not have for each other?
Yeah, it's interesting because while a lot of women see themselves now as equal earners in partnership or maybe even surpass their male partners and ideal primarily with heterosexual couples, but where you see this egalitarian kind of system on the surface, there are still these really ingrained expectations of gender underneath. Women, as most of you probably know, are still doing the bulk of housework on top of being the sole carers for children and also earning money. So there's a lot of strain that still gets placed on us to be everything to everyone. And that can put a lot of pressure on one's sex life. So I've seen that. And I also know from countless encounters with women who are dating and in partnership that there's this sense that when we are disappointed with our partners, there's not a sense that of empowerment to voice that concern. Because a lot of us were taught that when we get into a room with a guy, he'll know exactly what to do. And a lot of men feel that pressure as well. But I think it impacts women's ability to speak up for themselves in partnership, regardless of whether or not they feel like they are an equal partner. So these discrepancies are still existing and they still play out in a way that can impact the health and well-being of the couple.
Just so, and at Bumble, and this is interesting, I'd actually be curious if there's comparisons that you've made from going from Tinder to Bumble in terms of this empowerment, this pressure. Bumble puts a little bit of both the onus and the power with women.
Well, I think that there are two things that are happening. Mm-hmm. To go back to what Dan and Maisha were talking about initially, I don't see this issue of dependency as being exclusive to men and women. I think it's an issue of how couples are embedded within larger communities and the role that we now expect of our partners more broadly. Mm-hmm. So historically, couples were embedded within neighborhoods, within religious communities, within larger institutions, the family. Those institutions have changed greatly over time, which has led to this concomitant change in what we expect from both partners. So because we now don't go to our rabbi and we don't go to our friend and we don't go to our butcher and we don't go to our hairdresser and we don't rely on all of these other sources of people and we expect to receive everything that we need sexually, emotionally, religiously, what have you, from one person, it's unrealistic and it puts so much strain on the relationship that it does lead to this breakdown of this companionate relationship that no longer requires that degree of stability and financial dependency upon each other. So I think of it more from that angle in terms of trying to understand the sociological underpinnings of why our expectations of our partners have changed over time and has led to this degree of erosion within couples more broadly, which is why you now see also couples who have more resources and who are more embedded socially tend to have longer and more healthy relationships.
Interesting.
Yeah, I always tell people that back in the day there would be like an elder that you could go to who would be me. You know, I'm having issues with my person. Like when we were more communal and when we had more intergenerational support around us, there would be someone who would be like, yeah, you know, like you're really screwing this up. Like, you know, this is what you need to do, some guidance and support. But so many of my clients are living pretty isolated lives in, you know, major metropolitan areas is predominantly who I work with. And yeah, there is that sense of pressure that gets put on each partner. 100%.
What about any of the things that have changed that seem to be getting better? We kind of took a dark turn here briefly. You were like modern love, this is modern depression, what is happening? But and it's going to take a slightly dark turn for a second, and then we're going to turn it back around. But I think that there has been a lot of kind of uncovering of things that have been problematic in love for a long time that people are finally talking about. And I think there's a couple things here. One, people are going to coaches and going to therapists. And I'm wondering if there's been an uptick in things like that. Two, Dan, you worked with the New York Times on a campus consent project. That's pretty interesting that I'd love for you to talk about. And Jess, we were talking backstage about kind of the Me Too work that Bumble's doing. And so again, it's a little dark, but it's what's the power of things that we're using in these modern times to kind of uncover these things that have been terrible for a long time and maybe don't have to be anymore. So Jess, maybe I can start with you about the Me Too and Dan kind of chime in about the work that you did with the campus consent project.
Of course. So Bumble recently commissioned a study, which I led, which polled individuals, both Bumble users and non-users, in five different countries, the US, Canada, the UK, Mexico, and France. And we wanted to really understand how the Me Too movement has affected their daily lives, how they view relationships more broadly, how they view themselves and their relationships in the workplace. And we haven't released the findings yet, so I can't tell you too much. However, we have some wonderful and very positive... I know, I'm violating confidentiality.
You're just
getting broadcasted, Dan. And the New York Times is here, really? Oh, yeah. We'll talk later, Dan. Come on.
It's worth a try.
I could have had a date. Really, you know, I'm tired right now. He's preying on my weakness. So I'm kidding. So we had some really positive findings, though, about how women have felt more empowered in the workplace and in their personal lives as a result of the Me Too movement and how it's led to this higher degree of self-fulfillment, self-possession, and how they really feel as though giving a voice to these issues that have gone long unheard in terms of both workplace and romantic relationships has really helped women to try to step into the light and try to talk more broadly about what's happening with them day to day.
And Dan, you want to talk a little bit about the project that you worked on around campus consent? Because I think that kind of bringing things to light and these tools that maybe wouldn't have been possible before are pretty fascinating.
Yeah, this is a project that I proposed to my colleague and friend, Jess Bennett, who's the gender editor at the Times. And we'd been wanting to do a joint project. And this had to do with asking college students nationwide for stories that fell into some sort of gray area of consent, of you felt like this was not a good experience. It wasn't, you wouldn't call it rape. You wouldn't call it sexual assault, but it was something that felt pressured and uncomfortable, and this was kind of a big ask. We had to like craft this really carefully because we were asking people to trust us to send these stories that we would then print with their names on them, and we had expectations for what we would get, and I think we were both really surprised. I mean, I've been immersed in this world of people sending in their stories about relationships. Jess has been working in gender and with college students for a long time. And I think we were both kind of stunned by a lot of what came in. And what came in was story after story after story of women consenting to sex they didn't want. And like, what were the reasons for that? And there were so many reasons that made total sense and were baffling at the same time. And it was like, I don't want to be thought of as a prude. Mm-hmm. I thought that because I wound up alone with him, I owed it to him. Because I had allowed it to progress to this point, I felt like I had to follow through. It was one after another saying that. And the men were sort of just as flummoxed, and they were saying, like, to be a man, you're supposed to be in charge, and you're supposed to act like you know what you're doing. And to act like you know what you're doing is to be the aggressor and say, I'm the one who's had sex before. In one case, like, a guy had never had sex before, and he said, but he had to act like he had, and that he was the leader in this, or it was somehow emasculating. I mean, I was sort of stunned by the honesty of these pieces and what they taught us and what they taught the readers when we published them. We didn't intend to publish 45 of them, but we thought they had more impact in volume. I remember our top editor was like, 45 is a big ass. You have to say 45 stories, you know? And we're like, yes, we have to say 45 stories. And it ended up being really popular. It had a lot of readers. And I think if there's hope, we're looking for brightness here, right?
Mm-hmm. We're going to get there. Brightness.
This is the brightness. I think so many people who read these stories, and especially men, had no idea that their actions were unwanted. No idea. And one man, in response to that, and this happened with the Aziz Ansari piece too, one man after another was like, I've acted like that over and over and over. I shouldn't act like that. And that's the power of storytelling to me. You know, it's individual stories. This hurt me. And you see yourself in these roles, and I think that brings about change when you recognize it. I saw it happen.
Mm-hmm. I think, again, what we were talking about before, kind of like the fantasy versus the reality, and you guys are all kind of storytellers in your own way, you know, for different audiences. Do you get the sense that there's this hunger to talk about the reality when all you're seeing is the fantasy? Because I find out that, you know, somebody finds out you're a sex and dating coach and they're like, I have so many questions. And somebody's, you know, hungry for modern love because it's telling all these stories that maybe they're going to see one that feels like theirs. And, you know, Bumble is really trying to kind of unpack, and dating apps in general are kind of trying to help you find your person and find a dating app that fits your personality or what you're looking for. Do you get the sense that there's that hunger? And like, where have you kind of seen that in your work? Like, where you're able to break down that fantasy and bring people into the space where you can talk about reality, whether it's the hard stuff that gets to the good stuff or even finding the good stuff they didn't know was good. You know, I mean, I think you were talking a little bit backstage about, you know, people who have these great components of the relationships but are upset because sex is lacking. But it's because they think something's supposed to be one thing or the other.
Yeah, I know that people are eager to talk about sex because they've been talking to me about sex for my entire life. Like, so I work for the company that trained me, which is called Sex Coach U, and I have the pleasure of helping onboard students. And there, we have all this kind of similar story that we were the person that people went to when they wanted to talk about deeply personal and intimate things.
Do you remember the first thing that somebody came to ask you about?
Oh, totally. Yeah. I was a like middle school peer counselor and someone was like, my boyfriend wants to finger bang me. What do I do? I was like, I'm 12. I don't know. I don't know.
You were still the village elder in some way,
exactly.
Right?
But I was there to be with them in the room, and I was there to hear their story, and I was there to encourage them to think about what it was that they wanted out of the situation, and that really has continued to be my role. But yes, people are desperate to talk about sex, and I think one of the things that I love about my job is giving people that place, because I have clients who are like, I've never told a single person about this. I've never shared this with my sister who, you know, we know everything about each other. I've never told her I've had this problem. Like, she thinks everything's fine. I've never told my partner what I really want. And so being that person you know, that I've always been, but continue to be, that people feel really comfortable coming to and sharing these things with, I think is a great honor and privilege. And to be able to offer some assistance and guidance towards them being able to share that with other people. I've even given that as assignments. I'm like, your assignment is to call your sister and tell her that you're seeing a sex coach and talk to her about why. Because talking about these things, like you said, it's the power of storytelling. If we're not talking about these things, then we're all kind of going through it alone. And when we do share our stories, especially with people who we love and care for and who we trust, we open up a little bit of that space for holding space for them too, for when they need to come to us. And lo and behold, that normally happens when you tell a friend, like, this is something I'm experiencing, or this is something that's always been an issue for me. They have either a similar story, or they know of somebody else who it's happened to. So there's a lot that can be gained in kind of treading that water.
Also, people are going to, they're so hungry for stories that they're going to get their story somewhere. And if they don't get it from, if they don't get a real story, they're going to grasp onto a fake story, and that's going to be their guide. I get so much about, it's really revealing about the media and television and movies. And people really like living their lives according to movie characters and TV characters.
Which
and sitcoms.
Which one the most? Is there
well,
like something?
I got this great essay that I ran that was about a manic pixie dream girl.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
And
I read
it was
that
one. This writer from LA was in the thick of it, and he was in this relationship with this girl who had all the characteristics of a manic pixie dream girl.
Can you explain the manic pixie dream girl thing for people who don't get it? I know what that is. And Jess is nodding. So
I read the column.
I wonder how I can define it. I mean, there were certain characteristics of the manic pixie dream girl that I'm not sure I can list, but they had to do with being sort of wounded and probably tattooed and
like
having,
the Natalie Portman character in Garden
some addictions
State.
Of some kind. And you need to be rescued by a guy who's sort of straight-laced and wears like Oxfords and whatever. And then in the end, that straight-laced, reliable guy will win the day and the addictions will go away and she'll realize that he's going to save him from all of that, and his steadiness is what she needs because she's manic and she's a pixie dream girl and you know all that.
She's very cute.
And so he was in this relationship with a woman who fit all of those categories, and it got to sort of a crisis point. I'm trying to remember the essay. You might even remember it.
I can't remember exactly. I'm sorry, Dan. I've read too many of her columns.
In the end, she didn't want him, and he was like, but that's not how this goes. Like, that's not how this ends. This ends with you coming to me because of my squareness and embracing that and allowing that to save you. And he realized, like, this, my life isn't a movie, you know? It's just not. But the number of essays that I've received that especially go to Sex and the City scenarios, and it's like, you know, this is how this would be handled in Sex. And now I feel like I'm living that. I feel like there need to be real stories to fill that void, the incredible hunger for, like, what is the real story? What are people really supposed to do? And that, like, with this Sex and Consent series, it was like, oh, my God, like, what I did with her is what these people were doing, too. And to see yourself reflected in real stories, I think it's the most powerful agent of change there is.
That's pretty huge.
You're listening to a podcast of Inforum, an innovation lab at the Commonwealth Club. Support our podcast and find out about upcoming live events in San Francisco at inforumsf.org.
I'm actually going to pull one of the audience questions that I got submitted beforehand. And if you have questions or question cards, please send them up. We're about halfway through, so I promise I can get to some of them. A question about if you were going to teach a love and relationships course to high school or college students, kind of getting them early, if you will, maybe before they've binge watched Sex and the City on HBO since they're too young to have watched it ever. What do you think should be in that course? Like, what would you want as part of the curriculum there? Like, if we're talking about kind of banishing some of the fantasy versus reality, or things about how to find what you think you might be looking for, or I don't know, give me a couple things that you would want to see in that curriculum.
I would talk to them about the idea of choice. So my job is to essentially understand what our users want and to try to understand what our non-users want and to convert them to Bumble users. That's my job. I'm a Jew, but I proselytize Bumble, apparently. So that's pretty interesting to me. But when I'm talking to people, they often talk to me about how they're so overwhelmed by the number of choices on Bumble, Tinder, Hinge, JSwipe, Farmers Only, you name it, they're on it. And what I find to be so interesting, though, is that they're not able to disentangle and understand that not all choices are created equal. So when we've traditionally thought about choice from a behavioral and an academic perspective, we often go to the idea of a jar of jam. That's the classic example. And unless you are deathly allergic to strawberries, whatever marmalade you put on your toast in the morning will not affect you in a meaningful way. But the partner that you choose for your life will affect your health, your well-being, your offspring, etc. And we're also socialized from these fairy tales, from our observations, through these prosaic love narratives that we develop over time to understand what love is, and also it has far more meaning than a choice that's consumer-related, like Tide or Smuckers. So when we think about love from that perspective, I would want people to start thinking about choice more rationally in that regard. And I know that people aren't necessarily rational actors. But when I also talk to them about choice, they're not thinking about those, you know, thousands of people online and how they're actually faring when they're dating online. So, for example, if you're swiping on 100 people in a given day, and you only swipe right on 10 of them, so you're only saying you're interested in 10 of them, for those of you who have not used a swipe app, and then you only match with 5 of them, and then that means you both can talk to each other, and then you only actually communicate with 3 of them, you only go on a date with then 2 of them, and then you and the other person are only, you and only one other person are actually interested in each other. Only one of those 100 choices was actually viable. So I would want to start talking to people about how we think about choice from a rational and an academic perspective as how it would apply to love and their own decision-making, and try to get people to think about love and what they want in a partner, as well as the number of partners available, in a more rational way.
So no more soulmates, more game theory.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm super into that.
Yes.
Soulmate, that's, I'm going to call that the soulmate versus game theory course.
Yes, soulmate versus game theory. And but telling people, yes, you should maximize to try to find your soulmate. Maximize for the soulmate.
I like that.
That's the name of my course, Maximize for Soulmate.
That's like, yeah. I would buy that. I like this. I kind of want to hear what you guys think, because I think there's also this element of like, there's an opportunity to educate from both the ground up and the top down. I think it was interesting. I bet half the people in the audience who are on a dating app had a parent who was like, what are you doing? And like, that's a pretty interesting thing to have to explain this whole new kind of modern arena for maximizing for your soulmate. But what else, what would you guys put on a curriculum?
Well, I mean, I hear the word choice, and it's like fingernails on the chalkboard to me. Like, mm-hmm. For me, but I'm like a second born, and I've always just, I've always, like, every major decision in my life has come at me rather than me going after it. Mm-hmm. And I hate choice so much. And I,
these would be electives.
I don't like lunch stresses me out. You know, like a cafeteria is just a nightmare for me. And I like, you know, I like having the same thing. And I like having choice sort of delivered to me and limited. So I'm a believer in limited choice. And like, you aren't allowed to have all these other people at your disposal. You're allowed to have 5 people, and you're going to fall in love with one of these 5 people, and you're going to go on a trip, and one of them is going to, you know, win your heart. And if I were, that were me, that would happen to me. And
Dan, how did you meet your partner?
Huh?
How'd you meet your partner?
I'm not sure we have time really for that story.
But not on a dating app. How do you think you would fare now?
I would have loved dating apps, because I'd love to hide behind a screen and make, you know, pitch all these things out into the world and say like, oh, these people want to go out with me and that person wants to go out with me. And I would love that feeling of control, but it would all be a big illusion, and I'd be by myself the whole time.
See, that's what I that's what I see coming into my office, is that people feel like they do have all these choices because they are swiping right, but you really don't know. Like, for there is the illusion that behind the scenes, all these people are also liking you, even if like you don't swipe right on them. But the reality is, like, you really do match with the people who like you too. And then from that pool, it just gets narrower and narrower.
But what does it do to your mindset? This is what I'm interested in. What does it do to your mindset? Like, if you walk into a bar, you don't walk into that bar or party and think, man, everyone here wants to date me.
I tell people this all the time. I'm like, okay.
But so if you're on a dating app, the psychology of that is all these people are pitching themselves to you.
The idea even though
none of them would go out, you know,
right.
Maybe one of them out of 1,000 would go out with you.
But the illusion is that they are all available to
right.
you.
Not only that, but they're begging
up.
To go. They're like saying, here I am, you know,
yeah.
These are all my qualities. I'm so great. But I won't go out with you.
Right.
You know, that's sort of the subtext of it all.
Like, actually, a little bit of that. I'm going to slightly change the subject. Can we talk about ghosting for a second? Because I know that you have written about it. I know that dating apps are the king/queen of it.
Ghosting.
You ghosting. Like somebody disappearing. I've read enough of your college essay submissions that come through to be like, this is what people are dealing with. Like somebody just disappearing on you. And I'm sure this comes up for you too. That's an interesting space to be in. Like the idea of both so much quantity out there. And also kind of like this weird disconnect and like, how do you handle things like that? Like that to me is really interesting because that kind of runs counter to what you're saying. There's so many people out there, but do they really want to date you?
So I just did a lot of research for Bumble on this, and we're actually coming out with some new features soon. And I will talk about that, Dave.
Oh, good.
Okay.
That's
so
not
you can't
embargoed.
Have the full scoop. You can't
That's
have
not
the full
embargoed
scoop.
To next week?
Maybe. But I'll give you a hint. So essentially, you know, people are thinking when they're matching with people online that the match is actually a meaningful match in terms of this person's definitely interested in going out with me. I'm definitely interested in going out with them. But we know. Yeah, go ahead, Dan.
How often do people who match go out?
We don't have that data, which is really... This is why. It's really difficult. So at Bumble, I am subject to GDPR laws, which for those of you who don't know, are European laws related to privacy and security. So I can't go in and read the messages of people, unfortunately.
Oh,
they don't submit
bad.
Them to me the way it's Modern Love. It just doesn't work that way.
Do it catch you.
I know. We need to have you ask them to give it to me. But essentially, we don't have that data in a meaningful way. And people also don't want to volunteer it. Very few people relative to the general population want to submit themselves to surveys and what have you. We get enough for a statistically significant sample, but not enough to know meaningfully how many people are going on dates. We're trying to figure that out better, but it's all voluntary and therefore biased.
And probably voluntary for the people who succeed, right?
Yes, yes. So there's clearly a selection bias there. But back to ghosting, when two people match, the match may not be meaningful because the way that we swipe influences who we match with. So women are far more selective than their male counterparts. We know that it's both biological and market-based. For men, because they are acting on the basis of having so few women swipe on them, many men are swiping indiscriminately, which is highly unfortunate. So their selection process actually happens at the second tier, at the match level. So people are often baffled.
But they would also probably be satisfied with hundreds of women out there, right? They would probably be...
I don't think that's true.
Oh,
I don't
really?
Think. I think men can be more selective and more choosy. My husband's really choosy. I got lucky. He's not here tonight, but he would tell you like he had a list of criteria. And
it was you or no one.
It was. We broke up for a year and then we got back together. Our story would actually be a really good Modern Love column. We'll talk later.
You told us that you matched on 3 dating apps
in one day, and then our therapist brought us back together. But that's another story. But back to ghosting. I'm getting derailed by all the fun. Back to ghosting, because our swiping strategies are influencing when we match, our degree of agency in terms of whether we choose to message someone continues all throughout the process. So through the data, I found that people say that they're continuously making decisions about whether or not they want to interact with somebody moving forward. So I think that the problem with ghosting is that people don't have a meaningful or interesting way or an easy way of telling somebody in the process of corresponding with them, hey, I'm just no longer interested in you. It's easier to just let the conversation die because they've made the choice to say, I'm not interested, essentially, by just not saying anything. And that's really how people are resolving it, because we don't send people a message saying, hey, you know, this person's not interested in you anymore. You have to do it yourself if you're not interested.
It would not be that hard to write a text that says, you know, I had a good time with you, but I'm not interested in anything.
Dan, you did not do the dating app
scene. So the thing is,
right?
The thing, though, is, Dan, that, you know, these people have, like, there's a degree of variance in terms of the levels of correspondence people have. But if people stop corresponding after four messages, you know, there's the question of onus. You know, do I have to then tell somebody, okay, I've decided I'm not interested in you after talking to you for, like, 3 seconds online? It's not like you went out for 3 months, had sex, and met each other's friends.
Right, but
and
it's just like basic
but
kindness.
Ghosting, like, happens then too. And like,
yes,
I have a completely different take on ghosting. So there's ghosting within the app when you have not met and not made a, you know, significant connection with someone. And then there's ghosting after you have spent quality time with someone. They've even expressed interest in being your partner. Like, that type of ghosting, I think, has actually always existed, but I think the immediacy of texting makes it feel that much more harsh. Like, when you had to physically write a letter to someone, you gave that some time, you know, to like get a response. But I think now, like, we expect so much in terms of communication that ghosting has become this thing. I think the most interesting part of ghosting itself is like the actual ghost, which shows up in your social media. So you won't go out with me again, but you're watching my stories. So you won't answer my text, but you like my photos. Like, that ghost, that's really what I think we're feeling, that feels unfair, weird, like, why are you doing this? It's a presence in your life that I think is unexplained. It's just this weird phenomenon of like, why am I even dealing with you now? And that's what I see a lot of. But I think the general phenomenon of people losing interest and not getting back to you because it's difficult to say I'm not interested, that's been happening since we've been partnering. Honestly,
but I think it's changed. I mean, I
think changed,
I think ghosting is, I mean, it's a cowardice, but it's also a volume, you know, of like, there are all these people out there who are right in my pocket, and there are a lot more people out there, and I just don't want to deal with this. I want to move on. Mm-hmm. I'm so curious about the change of people committing to long-term relationships later in life. So, like, all of our 20s are our time for education and jobs and independence. And I get so many stories by people who are afraid, who want sex and they want emotional closeness, but they don't want it to be to be something that has expectations because they have other priorities. And that continues, you know, from your late teens through your 20s for a lot of people because they don't want that relationship yet. So what they're practicing is not vulnerability. They're practicing self-protection for years and years and years and years. And I don't think you can flip that switch so quickly to someone who is caring and kind and is looking for that something that requires more of you. And so when it comes to ending a relationship, your experience is coldness and move on, not I care enough about this person or about people in general, even if it's not this person specifically, to care about their feelings.
There also aren't the social and controls in place. You know, with online dating, there's very little accountability insofar as you probably don't have many connections in common. You'll never see them again. They're not in the neighborhood. You're not going to see them at Temple. You're not going to see them at Whole Foods. So the idea of being able to ghost is far simpler if you've only exchanged 4 messages with each other.
But it's always cowardice at the root of it.
I think it is. I agree.
I don't know that it's that cut and dried, honestly. I don't know how many people watch Insecure. I had a conversation. I'm not going to spoiler alert you, but what, you know, if you haven't caught up, please do, because it's a delight. But there's a situation where I had to explain to one of my married friends what had happened between two characters. I was like, he ghosted. And this is someone who deeply cares for the person who becomes overwhelmed, potentially. There's still a lot of questions about what's happening. As someone who has been ghosted upon, I
is that
understand.
What it is? It's ghosted upon,
I'm just spitballing here. But the recipient of someone's ghosting behavior sounds like too
You're
much.
A ghostie.
Too much. I'm the ghostie. I'm the haunted. Yeah, as someone who's lived this, I was very quickly able to communicate that to my friend who managed to avoid, you know, all online dating. And I think, to your point, Dan, like, it has become easier to do this. But I think that the challenge of being intimate and vulnerable with someone, it does happen for a number of reasons. Someone who ordinarily you would think is the right fit for you, it just becomes too real. And I don't think that's a mark of cowardice. I think that's a mark of not knowing oneself and the depths to which you can actually take your relationships. And that can be really scary for people in a way that there's an opportunity there, in my opinion, to learn about what it means to really be present with someone else, and also to expand what it means to be truly yourself in a relationship. There's a lot of people who have been married for decades and they are not themselves in a relationship. And when you meet someone who really strikes that chord with you, sometimes the reaction is to flee.
And there's also the dynamic where the person is the person who is the ghostie, the haunted, is will take any scrap of communication, and where the person who's you could make a conscious decision to completely go, you know, to drop out completely and not respond because there's this dynamic of I'll take any communication as a sign of hope.
Yeah,
and I can see that sort of being cut off. But I
once you've made that connection with someone, it's kind of hard not to.
Yeah,
you know, if that's all they're giving, there's a lot
of, you do
of,
it
like,
in one text.
So that's Dan's class, is text them
that's
back.
That's the rule. One text saying no more, and then you can ghost them.
So
and that's not ghosting.
I have an audience question that maybe will give you some room also to answer the kind of like, what would your curriculum be?
Cool.
So this person says, society has idolized the crazy love songs and the crazy love stories and the unhealthy love models. But how do you create a healthy love model for yourself? And how can you contribute to that kind of as a part of society?
Yeah, this does touch on my, like, ghosting comment. you know, I think for a lot of people, they haven't given themselves an opportunity to think about how they want to feel in partnership. And for me, that's largely, like, where I start with my clients. Because they've been so inundated with messages about how they should feel, they typically try to align themselves with, you know, well, I've got to have the guy with the great job and the car and the life figured out and everything. And I'm like, good luck. Not to, you know, it's not going to all be handed to you at once, right? And figuring out, okay, so you went on a ton of dates with guys who have all those things, but you're still really unhappy. How do you want to feel? How do you want that person? How do you want to be with that person? You know, and I don't think a lot of people have given themselves that opportunity to think about that and their own personal values, which can help you find partners that are phenomenal who, you know, might not have it all together all at once.
This is just, I'm going to ask you this because I think that Bumble has been doing a lot of work in this space to kind of do some kind of public education, if you will. And this question says, when you're a feminist who dates men, how much room should you give them to learn and grow? It seems that if I rejected all men who aren't self-aware feminists, there would be no men to date. And I think I've actually been really enjoying, I've really been enjoying watching some of the marketing that's come out of Bumble, because I think it's been this interesting combination of kind of confidence building marketing that's focused on the woman or the person as opposed to the who you're going to find. But there's also been kind of like an education component, I feel like, that has been coming out of Bumble's marketing more so, I would say, than other dating apps that I've seen recently.
Of course. Well, I think Bumble obviously very much leans into the feminist narrative of empowering women to make the first move and feeling confident and trying to gain equality in the dating process by changing one aspect of the dating script, which is obviously highly gendered. But I think that in terms of the question about growth, when you ask people, you know, do you believe in the social, political, and economic equality of men and women, the vast majority of the population answers yes. And that is the definition of liberal feminism from a classic sociological view. So if you don't meet a man who's a self-identified feminist, but if you ask him, you know, do you believe in the social, political, and economic equality of women and men, then you know that he believes in those things. So if you are a feminist and you want to find a man who believes in those things, then meet a man who believes in those things and then talk to him about things that bother you if you find that he says something that is not in line with your views. I think that everybody will be dating somebody who does something that bothers them, who doesn't agree with them on certain things politically. My husband and I don't agree about everything politically, but that makes us human. We're supposed to have different views. But if you are dating and you care about dating somebody who believes in feminism from a tenet perspective and a theoretical perspective, then talk to them about their values and ask them about their values rather than asking them about labels.
Can I speak to this?
Yes, by all means.
I totally agree that asking up front for feminism or for, you know, to align ideologically is incredibly important. And I know that there are people out there who will market themselves as feminists until you get in the room with them and then they say some fucked up shit. Sorry for cursing. And that's the experience that I have with a lot of my friends, myself, and a lot of my clients who come to me with that exact question. So I love this question. I want to like shout you out, whoever was brave enough to put that out there, because it's a big problem. And I write for Ravishly, and I wrote a piece about a feminist online dating survival guide. And one of the things I suggest, and I suggest this to my clients, is put your feminism in your profile. Put how you want to be treated in your profile. Put it out there because it's going to attract the people that are like, yes, I want that kind of woman. And the other guys aren't going to fuck with you. They're just going to be like, you're too much. And fine, I'm too much. But I got my boo on Tinder and I put that I was a feminist. So yeah, this is something that I feel really strongly about, that if those of us, including men, because I, in the Tinder process and online dating process, I saw a lot of guys who put that they were a feminist. I've gone on dates with them, and to varying degrees, I could identify with it. This one said toxic masculinity on our first date, and I was like, check. Like, this is the real deal. And, you know, those are the types of things that I think we can be looking for and also just expecting, because the more we expect it and the more we put it out there, it's supply and demand, people. Like, they will learn.
Okay, there's applause is allowed. No, this is, I mean, I think what's really interesting is you guys all come from really different perspectives on all of these, whether it's data driven or story driven or hearing these stories all the time. This question I think is interesting, and I want to kind of take it out just from the Bumble lens, but the question reads, Bumble is designed to empower women to make the first move, mm-hmm. but it's also available for matching queer women. Mm-hmm. What is the thought process for that user experience? How is Bumble supposed to function for LGBTQ? And I think that's not just Bumble specific, sure. But I also do kind of want to hear a little bit about how the conversation around non-heteronormativity has changed in all of the spaces that you guys work in. I think that's especially prevalent in the Bay Area. I think even reading about students, there's so much out there about how, you know, younger people are identifying very differently when it comes mm-hmm. to their sexuality and their relationships and their gender early on. But I want to start with that part and then kind of hear how you guys have thought about those different experiences for the LGBTQ population.
Of course. Well, I think that when Bumble started, it was really coming from a place of trying to change the dynamics between heterosexual men and heterosexual women. Mm-hmm. And because the same types of norms regarding gender do not exist within queer relationships, it was not within Bumble's capacity at that moment to make those changes. One of my main jobs at Bumble is to try to think about those issues. When I was at mm-hmm. Tinder, I was the individual who led the product change along with my colleague Drew Glicker, who's absolutely fabulous and still a product at Tinder, to try to make sure that individuals who want to identify in whatever manner they feel is most consistent with their gender identity can do so. And so I did a lot of research with transgender users as well as individuals who don't identify with the male-female binary. So I think that, and Bumble has taken and adopted that model for themselves. Mm-hmm. So I think that we are thinking about it meaningfully. It's hard, frankly, I'll be honest. And I don't think that most mainstream dating apps cater to the LGBTQ plus community in a way that they should. And they're working on it and they're trying. And I know that they are. But, you know, these apps are founded by people who are heterosexual. The vast majority of the population is heterosexual. So obviously, we're going to see that it will take time for there to be progress in that regard. But it's something that's absolutely top of mind. And I think that's something that I really deeply care about personally.
Any thoughts from either of you kind of in that space? Because I think it's something that I've definitely seen come up more in the Bay Area than I did when I lived other places, just those conversations and the importance of kind of continuing to redefine things that maybe we defined in one way. But as things shift, you know, obviously there's different user perspectives. We're going to use user as like a tech and also a normal
person. Yeah,
we've
seen. So we've done college contests every few years, and we're going to start doing them annually. But it's always a really interesting segment of the population to just see what people are struggling with in big numbers. I mean, I'm intrigued always by this sort of aspirational quality of relationships and love, where you always feel like you're going to do it better than the previous generation has done it. Like you look at your role models and you just say, we're going to do it better. And I'm not condemning of that at all. Like I'm not critical of it. I totally embrace it and I cheer it on. And but I'm curious about it. And in the last contest we held, we're announcing another one tomorrow, actually, to take place this spring. But in the last one, there was so much talk about terminology and labels. And what do you call things? And avoiding calling things anything. But
when you say things, relationships or identities or...
Well, it's a whole combination of things. It's some of it is gender fluidity. Some of it is not wanting to name something because there's a whole string of assumptions that goes... Like not wanting to name a relationship as being... Not wanting to name a boyfriend as a boyfriend or a girlfriend as a girlfriend, because then there's a whole trail of assumptions that goes along with that terminology. But then there's other sort of terminology that swoops in to replace it. Like there's a terminology void that then gets filled with all this other terminology and gradations of gender and race. And it seems simultaneously to be a generation that... that shuns terminology and is embracing a whole new wave of ever complicated terminology. Mm-hmm. And it gives the changing terminology happens so rapidly, even with things like pronouns. And, you know, it's kind of the times can be a funny place sometimes.
Yeah, you
it's
literally
a funny
have to think
place
about the words
when we're talking about standards of it's a very slow part of the times. Opinion page is liberal. As an institution, it's conservative, meaning it changes slowly. And language is a political force. And it's so interesting to see these debates. Like I get, you know, I'm starting to get essays where they is used as a singular. And how does that, so we have a broad readership. So we'll use that, but we have to explain it and educate through it. It creates sort of a layer of like people dealing with it and facing it. You know, that's what social change is. It's like forcing these institutions to grapple with it. And how are we going to inform people who are unfamiliar with these terms that we're not talking about the plural they, we're not making a grammar error. This is how it works, and this is how it gets pushed through. But for me, it's personally interesting to see it happen, to see it in action, and change things that are very hard to change. Oh my God, that's
It's really important for the times to be in a position to help that change.
And these are smart people who understand the issues. Like they're not dinosaurs. They're people who are more up on the news and more up on the changes in the world than anyone you know. But they're trying to balance a lot of things, and the balance, you know, it shifts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I have a question for all three of you. What are you the most excited about? I think we've definitely talked about some of the hard things, but I think a lot of the things that we've talked about also have a lot of potential. That's, you know, everything from the times working on gender neutral pronouns to, you know, thinking about the things that, you know, Bumble's able to push forward or things that you're talking about. What are you excited about? What gives you kind of some hope for the potential of modern love continuing to modernize in ways that's really interesting?
I would love to speak to this. Like, the fact that I, as a woman of color, have been able to have a podcast on my own and put that out where I'm helping people tell their sexual stories. It's a huge...
What's it called?
It's called Down for Whatever. And I am going into my fifth season, which will largely focus on stories of sexual assault and how we heal, which is a very ambitious project for me, but something that I felt really is important. But in the past, obviously with Down for Whatever, I have focused on marginalized stories, stories of folks who have different love stories, different sex stories, different experiences that have changed how they think about sex. And I've made it my mission to have those stories be as inclusive and diverse as I possibly can. And that's my mission as a coach as well. With how I write, I try to be as inclusive with when I'm talking about even anatomy, like and recommendations for products that I have. So that's really exciting for me, that I think the way that I'm thinking and conceptualizing sexuality, there's this amazing wave, particularly of female founders who are coming into the space of sexuality, and women of color, who are coming into the space of sexuality and sexology and saying, you know, hey, we've been left out of the picture for a really long time. We have our stories. We have stories of friends that we want to tell. And we also have a unique perspective on product. So that's another thing. Like, all of the sex toys that are currently being developed with really amazing technology behind them are finally getting produced by women and tested on women. Imagine that. And it's really remarkable, and something that I feel like I'm kind of in those conversations with a lot of female founders who have created a huge waves in the market for women to have sex toys that actually work for their bodies.
Wait, who are female sex toys being tested on?
like, no one. I mean, so this is
like
not
another hour-long.
I know, I'm like, this is not the
we'll
time or the
back.
Place. But my last episode of season 4 of Down for Whatever is an episode of an interview with Dr. Carol Queen. She talks about the history of the vibrator. There's an amazing vibrator museum here behind the Good Vibrations on Polk Street.
If you want to win a gift bag from there, go write us a haiku afterwards.
So, connections, mm-hmm. Boot twins. Anyway, and I definitely think that you should take a listen, because the history of how vibrators were created and just the disposability of them and the assumption that you know men would buy them for one-off uses with partners is fantastic. So just check it out. But that's changing, and materials are changing, and we now have vibrators that gather biodata and can tell you things about your orgasm and your experience. Yes, go to my website. And you know, yeah, there's amazing stuff happening that is female centered in a way that sexological research just never was before.
Dan, what are you excited about?
I'm not sure I have anything to add to that.
I think we'll go to Jess. You can keep thinking. Jess, what are you really excited about right now?
Well, oh, I didn't know that
ahead,
was
Dan.
The question.
Go
I thought
ahead,
it was about female
ahead.
Sex toys.
Go ahead, Dan.
Yeah, tell us your opinions.
So I'm just going to say, this is a little twist on our final question that we always ask our speakers, which is typically, what's your 60-second idea to make the world a better place? But I kind of like this, like, what are you most excited yeah. about? What's going to make modern love better?
Okay, I didn't realize that was a question.
Yeah, I just twisted it. I was like, we're running out of time.
Can we
I have
come
to
back
retwist.
To me?
Yes.
I'm really excited about the political energy of young people. And I don't think that I could have predicted that, because no one is really predicting how the political situation unfolded in this country. And I think it was long overdue that young people became as politically energized as they are. And I think it's going to have consequences all over the place that are positive. Yeah.
I think I'm really excited about some of the research that's recently been done about Me Too that we haven't totally disclosed this evening, and what it means for the women's movement generally, and also what it means for gender equity overall. I think that often we talk about Me Too as a very isolated movement towards women, or of women, or by women. But a lot of the research indicates how this movement needs to obviously expand to include men, because no real change can happen if everyone's not sitting at the table. So I'm really interested in seeing the progress that will be made by women around issues of workplace relationships and their social lives.
So in short, we could probably be up here for another hour. I'm thinking about, like, how do I get all of them back here to talk about sex toys? And we didn't even find out from Dan what it takes to get a Modern Love column published. Any tips? That's like a nice last note to end on. If you really wanted to get a Modern Love column published, what are like the key components? We're all looking at you very intently right now, for those of you listening on the radio.
It's a balance of vulnerability and intelligence.
I'm taking notes.
That's all it takes.
Get vulnerable.
Get vulnerable and get smart. Interesting. I like it.
Really writing that.
Well, so I really want to thank you guys. I think this was, like I said, I would love to keep the conversation going, and feel free to find our speakers at the reception to follow if they're going to plan to stick around. But thank you so much for joining us tonight at Inform at the Commonwealth. Big thanks to our speakers, Jess Carboneau from Bumble, Dan Jones, editor of the New York Times Modern Love column, and Maisha Battle, sex and dating coach. We're going to keep drinking and hanging out and having fun and asking them questions in the lobby, but happy Valentine's Day. Thank you. And one more thing. When you go outside, we actually left some lists of the 36 questions to fall in love. That was one of the most popular columns from the New York Times. They are not just for falling in love. They're for making new connections. So pick one up. Use it as an excuse to talk to a stranger. I'm Marissa Levine. Have a great night.